This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, men from Mexico brave the elements, washing windows high above the windy city of Chicago.
Pues con miedo, la verdad.
Honestly, it was scared. It was scary. First thing I said to myself, this is not the line of work I want to be in, but, you know, it just takes time to get used to, and now everybody's comfortable.
Plus, overworked, underpaid, and totally devoted. A day in the life of a school teacher in Ghana.
Through hard work and dedication, one can make something good out of children who think they can do anything.
And an Afghan-American journalist searches for her uncle, who disappeared at the hands of the communists almost 30 years ago. All that and more coming up on the World Vision Report. Years ago, Refugio Ramirez left Mexico for Chicago. When he got there, he found a job. But this was no ordinary job. He worked hundreds of feet above the ground, braving the elements, washing the windows of skyscrapers in the windy city. And that started a tradition. Today, nearly 100 other men from his small village in Mexico are window washers in Chicago. Sandy Hausman talked with a few of them and filed this report.
12 years ago, Jose Ramirez followed his uncle Refugio to Chicago. He hoped to make his fortune using skills he'd learned in the high pastures near Garcia de la Cadena, a small town in the foothills of the western Sierra Madres.
Yo creo que vivo en un rancho y trabajo.
He said he worked in the ranch with ropes and everything. He said that he had to make sure the cow won't go anywhere. So he using knots and ropes and everything, and he's using the same knots he used in the past.
Ramirez uses his ropes and knots at Service One, a company that cleans the windows of skyscrapers. He sits on a small canvas seat attached to a rope anchored to the roof. Like a mountain climber rappelling down a steep cliff, he eases himself over the edge and begins to work, spreading soapy water from a bucket at his side, then using a squeegee to wipe the window clean. He doesn't look down, but people on the ground are looking up, snapping pictures and marveling at the spider-like creature swinging hundreds of feet above. Jose admits that at first it was frightening.
Pues con miedo, la verdad.
Honestly, it was scared. It was scary. First thing I said to myself, this is not the line of work I want to be in, but, you know, it just takes time to get used to, and now everybody's comfortable.
In fact, he now looks forward to his high-altitude vocation. It's exciting. A unique thrill, and 90 stories up, there's no boss looking over your shoulder. If you work hard and finish early, the extra time is yours. And the pay is pretty good, enough to support a wife and two children, to buy a truck and a car, and to send money home. He and his brother Raul help support 9 siblings back in Mexico. The money goes for food and medicine, but it doesn't keep family members from worrying. Jose's mother often begs him to quit.
No, say, oh, no, no, son, no more this job.
She gets worried. She told him to stop.
The window washers are calm and deliberate as they go about their work, but they know the job carries risks. Salvador Mariscal works for Corporate Cleaning Services, the company hired to handle one of the world's tallest buildings, the John Hancock Tower. Often, Mariscal says, he prays.
Yeah, all the time. All the time when I start, I do this morning because you never know what happened. And that building is too high. You got 101 floors, I think. You start watching the windows in the 97, so it's all the way down to the second floor.
And if Jose Ramirez forgets to pray, there are days when the weather reminds him.
Sometimes, yeah, it's maybe too windy, oh, yeah.
He's reassured by the fact that none of his friends or relatives have been killed on the job, and his uncle, that first window washer to come from Garcia de la Cadena, has now retired comfortably to his ranch in Mexico. There he advises other young men who want to follow in his footsteps. But as much as they love their jobs, these workers hope their children will not follow them up the skyscrapers of Chicago. Refugio Ramirez, the son of that vanguard window washer, hopes his own boy will find another line of work.
Él está estudiando para que trabaje en otro trabajo. No en esto.
He's going to school so he can hopefully get another job and not do this.
Most of the window washers plan to stay in the United States, but a few will retire to Mexico. And not a moment too soon. Garcia de la Cadena has an 80-foot-tall church, and when it needed repair, the window washers sent safety equipment home for the job. But no one in the town of about 3,500 people came forward to scale the steeple. perhaps because the pay was low, or maybe because all of those brave enough had moved to Chicago. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sandy Houseman.
Many immigrants who come to work in the U.S., like the window washers, send a good portion of their paychecks back home. Most of them use Western Union to transfer their money. The company used to be known for its telegram service. But when telegrams died out, the company almost went bankrupt. It's doing much better now. There are more Western Unions around the world than McDonald's, Walmart, Starbucks, and Burger King combined. And the company is worth billions of dollars, mostly thanks to migrants sending money home to their families. Jason DeParo covered this story for the New York Times.
Globally, migrants send home about $300 billion a year, which is more than three times the combined foreign aid budgets of the world. So when you think about the amount of money that flows from the rich world to the poor world, remittances, the money that migrants send home, is that's really where the action is. And Western Union has by far the largest market share of any money-sending company. It's four times larger than its closest competitor. Western Union controls about one-seventh of the remittance market.
And Jason, when you travel around the world as a reporter for the New York Times, is it easy to find a Western Union?
Yeah, that's what got me interested in the story initially. I was in rural Nepal. We had flown to Kathmandu and driven about 12 hours outside Kathmandu. And you know, it was one of those places where I really thought I had found the end of the earth. And we got to a small hostel late at night. It was dark. And when I woke up and looked out the window in the morning, there was a Western Union sign across the street.
Really? So they're everywhere.
They're not owned by Western Union. They're kind of like franchisees. They're agents. So often they're located in other organizations, like the Chinese Post Office is an agent of Western Union, or the Indian Post Office. So any place there's an Indian Post Office, there's a Western Union office.
What are the fees? Let's say a migrant worker in New York City wants to send $100 home to Mexico. What does he have to pay in fees to Western Union to do that?
It very much depends on where you're sending from and where you're sending to, and it depends on who's across the street to compete. The rates change constantly. It can be as low as 3 or 4% and as high as 30%.
And has there been much complaint on the part of migrant groups about these fees? I mean, I would imagine that over a year's time, by the time you add up the fees these people pay, how much work does a migrant worker have to do just to cover his fees to Western Union?
Right. A lot of the advocacy groups have been critical, not only for the extent of the fees, but for the way the fees are set up. There's a big lawsuit against Western Union 7 or 8 years ago that said it was insufficiently disclosing its fees. Two things happened. One was increased competition. A number of other money transfer companies cropped up and to compete with Western Union. So the fees have been coming down. There were a lot of critics of Western Union who said, gee, it's taking advantage of poor people. You know, this amounts to a kind of invisible tax on the poorest immigrants, on their hard-won earnings. On the other hand, there's always been a paradox, which is that the people who use the service by and large like it. And one of the reasons they like it is because they trust it. They know that the money's going to get there. So yes, it's expensive, but it's reliable. The main alternative before Western Union was giving it to a friend, handing $300 to a friend or a relative or your brother-in-law who you thought was going home to Mexico, and you would hope that the money got there, but it, you know, lots of ways it could have gotten lost along on route. Western Union, you can walk in, you can give $300, and before you leave the store, your relative can be standing at a Western Union outlet in Mexico, and you know, you both walk out of the office at the same time with knowing the money's gotten there.
Most Americans use banks to transfer money. What does Western Union offer that banks don't?
Sometimes they're cheaper, sometimes they're not, but you have to have a bank account. So lots of immigrants don't have bank accounts.
Now, Jason, you mentioned that there had been a lot of criticism, and still is, I'm sure, of Western Union charging these fees, some of them very high, for immigrants to send money home. And as a response to that criticism, they've actually taken some steps to show themselves as good global citizens. What actually has Western Union done as a company to reach out to migrant groups?
There's a Western Union Foundation. They've done a lot with disaster relief, hurricanes, typhoons, particularly you know, in developing countries when they come through and cause so much damage. Western Union is known, I think, for contributing to disaster relief.
Jason, on this show, we have covered cell phones as a new mode of money transfer, especially in Africa. How significant do you think this competition will be?
the people who follow Western Union are very divided over that. Some think it could be the equivalent of email and put them out of business in money transfer the way email put them out of business in telegrams. And the other people, the skeptics on that, argue that new technologies have been threatening the money transfer business for a decade. You know, the internet, sending money over to computers, and that in the end you still need a point of cash to get the money onto the phone. Just like you need a bank account to use the banks, you still need a place to go and put the money in and get the money out, and that only Western Union's got that global network.
Interesting. All right, Jason DeParle, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure.
Jason DeParle is a reporter for the New York Times. We spoke to him from Washington, D.C. Two years ago, the West African country of Ghana did away with school fees. As a result, 600,000 more children flooded the school system. The change might be good for students, but it hasn't been easy for teachers. In Ghana, as in much of Africa, teachers are often vastly underpaid and undereducated. Now they're seeing their class sizes and their workloads soar. Prue Clark spent the day with one school teacher in the southern coastal village of Fosu. She brings us this installment of our series, A Day in the Life.
Very tired.
It's 4 a.m. as Sylvia Naughty pushes back the sheet and greets the day. It's just becoming light outside as the pretty 36-year-old sweeps her tiny three-room apartment.
Good morning, Jesus.
Her modest concrete dwelling is one of several built to lure teachers like Naughty to this rural part of the country. In a rudimentary kitchen, Naughty begins preparing breakfast. She has no electricity or running water, so she starts a charcoal fire in a pit at her front door and boils water from a bucket she fills at a borehole once a week. She whips up donuts to sell at school to supplement her meagre teacher's salary. Next, it's time to wake the tiny bundle asleep in a bed in the living room.
Hello, Blessing. Hello, Inshira.
Three-year-old Pacho is Naughty's son. She was married briefly to his father. After the wedding, he revealed another wife and children. Polygamy is traditional here, but Naughty, a devout Christian, doesn't believe in it, and so she left. Only later did she discover she was pregnant. The English translation of her little boy's name is Blessing.
Are you ready to take in your tea?
Yes.
Come and sit down. Do you like some eggs?
No.
Today you don't like any eggs.
After breakfast, Naughty and a cheery Blessing bathe in a bucket and then dress. By 7, they're out the door.
Let's go. Be a good boy. I'll carry you. I'll carry you at my back.
Naughty drops Blessing at a nearby kindergarten and takes the 10-minute walk to work.
Are you going? Get your class. 1, 2, 3.
Naughty's second graders take their seats in rows of old wooden desks. There's no glass in the windows to block outside noise, but 25 little faces are entranced. Naughty glows with warmth. She smiles and moves from desk to desk, enveloping the children in a motherly love.
Put your pencil down. Class 10.
First up, a class stretch.
Down, up. Forward stretch. Sideways stretch. Up.
Then it's singing.
1, 2.
This is a good day. Only 3 of Naughty's 28 students are away. Often the class is much smaller. Parents will keep their children home if they can't pay for a child's lunch or for notebooks. Getting rid of school fees eliminates just one of the barriers parents face. Uniforms, shoes and books can all be out of reach of families surviving on a dollar a day.
How much is one exercise book?
For their level, this one is 700 each, and they are supposed to get 12 for the whole year.
700 Ghanaian cedis is about 8 US cents. One US dollar will buy all the notepads, pencils and erasers a child needs for a year.
One US dollar.
One US dollar.
Yes, and they can't afford it. This.
Teachers often dip into their own pockets. Just this morning, another student came to tell Sylvia she was an orphan and her uncle could no longer pay for her.
Because I was so much touched. So I promised I'll also help the little that I can.
Naughty spends about one-sixth of her pay on her students. She even has to buy her own chalk. At lunch, children take a bowl and line up for stew. A local woman cooks the food and children pay about 10 cents each. That way the kids get at least one meal a day.
We have a lesson this afternoon.
Back at school, class resumes.
What lesson we have this afternoon? Yes, Emmanuel. Mathematics. Clap for him.
Naughty's class is lucky. She's the first teacher they've had with graduate school training. Many teachers haven't even finished college. Some schools have to rely on high school seniors to do the teaching. Because of poor teaching in the past, Naughty's students are way behind their grade level. She's working hard to help them catch up.
I want someone to write the number 9 on the board for me. Seth wrote this. What is this? The letter P. This is the letter P. We want 9. I want someone to write better.
The influx of new students into Ghana schools has created a severe teacher shortage here. But there's little financial incentive to enter the profession. An overworked teacher with a graduate degree and 15 years of experience, like Naughty, takes home just $150 a month. That allows her to buy basic necessities, but save almost nothing.
So I feel undervalued because when I look at my friends, my colleagues who I completed a secondary school with, who are in the banks, they own their own cars, they have their own homes, and I don't have a car, neither do I have a bicycle, even to ride on.
Ghana's teachers went out on strike for 10 weeks last year over salaries. The government agrees teachers are underpaid, but insists it can't afford to pay more. But Naughty says she's doing something more important than people who make more money.
I'm bringing up Ghana's future, the children who are our future.
That evening, it's time to prepare a dinner of smoked fish stew, plantains, and the cassava and yam dough called fufu that Ghanaians eat with every meal. Naughty and Blessing eat on stools outside.
Eat and grow fast for me. I want you to be a big man.
Sylvia Naughty has thought about leaving teaching. She worries she'll not be able to afford to give Blessing the same opportunities she had as the child of a middle-class businessman. But she loves her job. She recalls one of her first posts, an isolated fishing village where she and the children didn't even share a language. She brought in books and pictures and found a way to communicate with them.
I made an impact in the lives of the children. And I know they are going to come up with very good grades because of the foundation I give them. Through hard work and dedication, one can make something good out of children who think they can do anything.
By 6 o'clock, as the equatorial light fades, the family retires indoors. Naughty puts Blessing to bed and prepares her materials for tomorrow's class. For the World Vision Report, I'm Prue Clark in Fosu, Ghana.
Fariba Nawa is an Afghan-American journalist. She returned to Afghanistan last summer and set off on a search to find her uncle. He'd been taken prisoner by the communist authorities in 1979. Fariba filed this story.
My father's brother, Fazl, was the star of his family. He was a professor at Kabul University's pharmacy department, a kind man and an avid reader who was busy raising 5 children. So in the spring of 1979, my family was shocked when he was taken prisoner by communist authorities. My aunt searched for him without success. We never heard from my 43-year-old uncle again. 28 years later, I was going back to Kabul to work, and I was determined to speak with a man who might know my uncle's fate. Asadullah Sarwari was the chief of the secret police during the time my uncle was jailed. He himself is in prison now awaiting a trial on charges of mass murder. I met Sarwari in his jail cell. After an hour of talking, I put my pen and paper down and looked him in the eye. I asked him if he knew Fazl Ahmad Ehrari. He said no. I told him he was my uncle. I said, "You must know what happened to all those who disappeared. My uncle was among thousands who were jailed as political prisoners and never heard from again." He said the people who did know had all been killed. So I went to speak to my uncle's former students and colleagues. Hassan Furutan studied under my uncle and is now a professor at Kabul University. He told me the last time he saw him, My uncle was walking down the stairs of the department with an unknown man. Frutan said the color in my uncle's face was gone. He had handed his briefcase to a colleague and told him to give it to his wife. He knew he was in trouble, Frutan said. Then the unknown man drove my uncle away. But why would they take him, I asked. The head of the pharmacy department was a member of the ruling Communist Party, and in an effort to protect him, he had warned my uncle not to associate with members of an opposing party. But my uncle had not listened. He could have been jailed simply for talking to them. Then he told me that my uncle had been killed under torture. My heart fell. But where was my uncle's body? Frutan looked at me blankly and said he didn't know. I came back to the U.S. with a cold trail that ended in death. Now I had to share this with the people closest to my uncle. My father keeps repeating the details of my journey to any and all who visit our house. Perhaps it's his way of trying to grasp his brother's fate. Aunt Raufa, Uncle Fazil's wife, now lives in the U.S. When I called to tell her my news, she was upset. I suggested holding a memorial service to give my uncle a peaceful rest, but she said an emphatic no. I prefer that he has disappeared. I don't want to see a body. I don't know what I would do if I found out that he's dead for sure. It's better like this, she said. I hung up the phone, and for the first time since I had begun my journey to learn my uncle's fate, I burst into tears.
Fariba Nawa is a freelance reporter who now lives in California. Most of us have family photos somewhere, on our walls or in photo albums, even on our computer screens. We tend to take these snapshots for granted. But imagine if we didn't have a record of our families or our friends. Mark Beach is an aid worker in Brașov, Romania. He works with the Roma population there. These modern-day gypsies are among the poorest people in Europe. For them, having a family portrait is a luxury they can only dream about. Mark was recently delivering food to poor Roma villagers. That's when he discovered the power in a picture.
We'd gone through handing out 220 hampers, and that was a full day. And we were pretty exhausted. And one of the ladies, I could see she was struggling. She had one child in each arm. Her kids were too young to help her carry this stuff back. So I offered to help her. As I dropped the food off, she saw that over my shoulder was a camera. And she looked at me and she said, "Can you please take a picture of me and my children?" And I looked at her and, you know, I was so tired. And in my mind, I calculated what that question meant. It meant me taking a photograph, going back to the town, which is half an hour away, going to a development place, having the digital photograph put onto paper, taking it back out, maybe a frame. I mean, that's not a lot of work, but compiled with the fact that in a village like this, you can't do anything for one person. You have to do it for the entire village or nobody. So all that tied into this question, my mind just was racing, and I had to look at her and say, you know, I don't think I can do that. And she said, "Please, we have no record of our children." She says, "Not just me, but anyone in this town. Our parents are growing up, people are living and dying here, and we have no record." And, of course, that just went right into my heart. And I looked at her and I thought, oh, you know, I've got to be able to try and help the situation. But I had no immediate answer. So I had to turn to her and say, I can't help you. The next day I woke up in the morning and I just had this idea. And I thought, well, gosh, why don't we just take a photograph of the entire village. Now, on the edge of the gypsy village is the Romanian part of the town, and they have an elementary school. So I arranged with the principal to use one of her classrooms. First, my heart was pounding because I thought nobody's going to show up. And that day, we had the team of volunteers, and everyone was busy with their 35mm lenses, making sure the lighting was right. We put up the backdrops on the wall and got some of the chairs ready. And so we came at the time that we had established, and, well, it was the entire village. My heart was so moved when I saw the first few families come in because I suddenly realized just how important this was to them. nobody had ever offered them an opportunity to have a family portrait done. And we just started shooting, and we shot nonstop for 4 days. At first, they were terrified when they came in because they're used to fearing authority of any kind. Because the gypsy population is probably the most despised people group in all of Europe. And they can feel that. So when they came into the classroom, they had a very military look. They were going to stand for their photo, no smiling, very stiff. So I had to teach everyone the word in Romanian for smile, smile, you know, and we had to try and get them to smile and use little props and that sort of thing to get them to laugh. And then we just start shooting on auto shoot, you know, chum, 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 and get maybe 5, 6, 7 shots to catch them in a smiling mode, which was who they really are once they step outside that classroom. We captured smiles and just parts of their personality that they would never have shown us otherwise. And it was just fantastic. Told them, come back on Saturday at 10:30 to get your photo. How we did this is that the elementary school had a really nice long hallway with a door on one side and a door on the other. So we took desks out of the classroom and ran them all the way down this very long hall and took the 220 photos and put them on all the desks. And we announced to everybody that they had to walk through once just to look at them all, go out the other side and walk around and come back in and then take their photo. So that's what we did, and the lines came through and looked at them, and of course everyone's pointing and cheering and laughing, and oh, there's my aunt, there's my uncle, there's my sister, there's... And so it was a really festive, exciting day. I remember when the original woman who asked me whether I could take a picture of her and her family came back in because it was her question that sparked this entire idea. When she came walking into the classroom, our eyes met and she smiled. I smiled back at her, and for me it was a half apology and half a thank you for such an awesome idea. And we took a photo of her, and it was a fabulous shot.
Mark Beach is president of Hope for the Nations, a Christian humanitarian organization that works with at-risk families in Romania. If you'd like to see some of the family portraits he took that day, check out our website, worldvisionreport.org. And that brings us to the end of our show this week. Remember, you can hear us anytime online. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.